"For us to survive for a month," he said. I thought it was his usual impulsiveness. I thought it was Dad. I thought the food would collect dust in the basement for decades. I never thought I'd eat it. But I did. I lived on that cash for 2 weeks. I'm not sure if I survived, though. 2 weeks alone in a house. It did something to a person. All those years alone in a house with my father. It also did something to a person. I could see that as I roamed the empty house, waiting for someone to call, to show up, to say my name. No one did. Why would they? I was already dead. As the rain continued to fall and the phone continued to not ring and the doorbell continued to stay silent, I went through my father's things. Without him there to put it all in context, to make it seem, if not normal, then typical, or at least Dad, I understood the water had been boiling for some time. Under his bed, I found the stash of mood stabilizers, the drugs Mom had insisted he take if he wanted to retain full custody after Mary died. The drugs I dutifully picked up at the pharmacy in town every month. The drugs I poured him a glass of water before bed each night to swallow down. He'd been hoarding them. For years, it looked like. Next to that box was Mary's old suitcase. Inside were the notebooks where he'd written his theories, gleaned from the documentaries he'd watched over the years. The healing tree frogs and his absolute certainty that the cure to Mary's cancer was in our forest. The man who wrote the longest novel in history, discovered only years after his death, setting off a search for the thing he would create to leave behind after his death. The one about empaths. The one about suicide tourism. The one about the seeing blind man. There were pages and pages of notes, drawings, quotations. It seemed normal enough. Dad enough. Until I got to the entry about people who had learned to harness all 100% of their brains. Dad had written pages and pages on this particular documentary. According to his notes, most humans utilized only 10% of their brains, but the people in this film had found the ability to access close to 100% and had accomplished superhuman feats like flying and learning dozens of languages. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is. Infinite, Dad had scrawled. I remembered when Dad first told me that. It was the day we'd gone out into the forest blindfolded, in search of limitless sight. I knew my life had changed that day, but I belatedly understood that his had too. A lot of the films Dad watched were rife with conspiracy theories, which was why I'd stopped watching with him. This one had sounded particularly outlandish, but also familiar. I tried to recall it, and when I did, I realized it wasn't a documentary at all. It was a science fiction movie. Not long after that, I discovered my father's copy of The Lord of the Rings. The pages were darkened with underlined passages, full of doodles and quote call-outs, theories scrawled into the margins, epic ideas about the location of Middle-earth. Had my father lost the ability to distinguish between science fiction and documentary, between real and imaginary, between Middle-earth and Earth? Had he ever had it in the first place? Fellowship of Two. Had I? Just us, buddy. It was hard to read the book with all his scribbles, but as the rain continued, I forced myself. I read it cover to cover, out loud, as my father had read it to me all those years ago. It had taken him 6 months to read it to me. It took me 5 days to read it to him. The rain continued to fall. The water continued to boil. It rained the entire time I was reading. It was only when I got to the very end, when Sauron has been vanquished and Frodo and Bilbo leave the Shire, that the rain began to slow to a drizzle. I paused for a moment at the last page. My voice was hoarse. My nerves were shot. My heart was broken. And for a moment, I was transported back to the day when we finished reading the book the first time, before my mother left, before Mary died. "Why does Frodo have to leave?" I'd asked my father, distraught about the dissolution of the Fellowship. "Why doesn't Sam go with him?" "Because Frodo was damaged in a way Sam wasn't," my father said. "Why?" "Because of the beautiful, terrible burden of the ring." "Where is Frodo going?" "To the west. To the undying lands."
"Does he go there so he won't die?"
"I think so he can heal."
"Can we go there?"
"Someday. If we need to." I put the book down. I walked to my father's closet, ran my fingers over the fading list. The places were all there. New York City, Rivendell, Mount Denali, the Shire, Angkor Wat, the Undying Lands. Dozens of places, some real, some make-believe. We hadn't gone to any of them. Next to the list was a mirror, old and scratched. I caught a glimpse of myself in it. I hadn't showered or shaved or even changed my clothes in 2 weeks. I looked feral. I looked like a madman. I looked like my father. The rain stopped. I called the airline. I gathered up all of Dad's notebooks and went to the forest, to the place where we'd spread Grandma Mary's ashes, where we'd buried the birds we couldn't save, the frog he hadn't meant to boil, to the place where Dad had tried to find limitless sight and I'd lost half of mine. I ripped out a single page from one of the notebooks and laid the rest in a pile. I lit them on fire. The flames danced and hissed, the sodden earth steaming under them. And soon the notebooks, like everything else, had turned to ash. I showered. I shaved. I changed my clothes. I emptied out the refrigerator. I packed a small rucksack with a few changes of clothes I wouldn't need, with Dad's copy of The Lord of the Rings. I put the key under the mat. I walked down the driveway for the last time. I walked 2 miles to the bus stop. When I boarded the bus, there were people on it, but I no longer felt like one of them. My axis had shifted. I was invisible. I was already in the Undying Lands. I went to the bank and withdrew the rest of the money that Grandma Mary had left me. I went to the library and checked out an outdated guidebook I knew I'd never return. I threw my library card in the trash. I rode another bus to the airport. As the plane climbed above the trees, the clouds, the mountains, I didn't look down.
7. The Swallowing of Secrets. Freya tears down unfamiliar streets, past the buttoned-up modest frame houses, past the cemetery, its flowering trees ghostly in the quiet, moonlit night. She calls out, "Nathaniel, Nathaniel, Nathaniel."
In the silence that has descended upon the dining room, Harun hears Freya calling to Nathaniel. It mingles with the muffled sound of Ummi sobbing upstairs and Halima's inaudible comforting words. There had been so many of them before, his parents, his siblings, his friends. And now there's no one left but him and Abdullah, was staring hard at the table, as if straying his glance even an inch will cost him something dear. "Abdullah," Harun asks, "what should I do?" His brother won't help him. He won't even look at him. It is the thing he knew would happen, the thing he feared would happen, being cast out, being alone. But just because he anticipated it doesn't mean he's prepared for it. The wallop of anguish is so powerful it separates Harun from his body, so he's floating outside himself, watching from above as he picks up Nathaniel's discarded backpack, opens the front door to the only home he's ever known. Before he closes the door behind him, he turns back to his brother. "I used to want to be a pilot," he tells Abdullah. "Did you know that?" Abdullah doesn't answer, because of course he didn't know that.
Freya stops in front of a closed auto body shop, momentarily disoriented. "How did I get here?" she asks herself for the second time that day. But then she remembers how. Harun. Nathaniel. She regains her bearings. She continues looking.
Outside, Harun walks down his block, past all the other houses, warm lamplight and the blue splash of TV spilling out of drapes. Houses holding families still intact. He hears Freya's sad lament. "Nathaniel!" All day long, he has witnessed them fall in love with each other, as he fell in love with them too. People think love can't happen that fast, but he loved James the minute he saw him. "Nathaniel!" Freya calls. Harun holds his breath, waiting for Nathaniel to answer.
Nathaniel does not answer. How can he? He cannot hear. He cannot see or be seen. His world has collapsed once more. A black hole sucking up all the space where light, where love, where laters might live. There's just emptiness. "Just us, buddy." "As it always was. As it always will be."
Freya returns to Harun's house. Halima is sitting on the cement stoop next to the driveway. "Did you find Nathaniel?" Halima asks. Freya shakes her head. She didn't find him. She didn't warn him. She didn't even give him back his $50 bill. And now he's out there, alone and broke. "Is Harun okay?" she asks. "I don't know." Halima hangs her head. "I came downstairs and he was gone. He's not answering his phone. Maybe he went to James's?" "I doubt it." As soon as Halima says this, certain things become clear to Freya. Harun has not spoken to James all day, in spite of the fact that she's supposedly his favorite singer. "I think they broke up," Halima says. "I mean, I don't know for sure. He never told me. But I suspected that he was gay, and I suspected he was with someone. And once, I followed him into the city and saw him meet up with a guy." "James?" Freya asks. "I think so. But I never told him. Even when this whole marriage thing happened, and I knew something had gone wrong." She puts her face in her hands. "But I never told him I knew he was gay. I let him bear it alone." She looks up at Freya, eyes so very solemn. So very much like her big brother's. "I think I failed him." "I think I did too," Freya says. Halima wipes away a stray tear. "I'm not supposed to be driving at night, but I'm going to look for him. Maybe he went to the PATH station. It's not that far. Will you come?" "Of course," Freya says. They climb into the car and crawl down Sip Avenue. The stores are all shuttered. There's hardly anyone out. It's like the night has swallowed everyone and all their secrets up. When they get to Journal Square, Halima sighs. "Maybe it's better if I go home, in case he comes back," Okay, Freya says, not knowing where to go. I guess I'll get out here. Maybe I'll bump into him on the train. But she doubts it. Finding each other like they did was... she doesn't know the word for it. Luck? Fate? Miracle? But she's pretty certain, whatever it's called, you only get so much of it in a lifetime. Let alone a day. If he gets in touch with you, Halima begins. He can't, Freya says. We only met today. He doesn't even have my phone number. So give it to me, Halima says. I'll text you his number and give him yours. And you call me if you hear from him, and I'll do the same. Okay, Freya tells Halima her number. She opens the door to the car. If you see him, tell him... Halima trails off, gesturing behind them toward the quiet streets, toward home. My parents need time. They thought he was going to Pakistan to marry a girl. They're in shock. But they love him. They just need time. Do you think so? Freya asks. Did time heal everything? Or were some things broken beyond repair? I don't know, Halima admits. But if they can get used to Lisa, they can get used to anything. Freya chuckles ruefully. Fair point. Halima leans in to hug Freya. I was looking forward to learning to cook with you, she whispers into Freya's ear. I always wanted a sister. Me too, Freya says. The Order of Loss, Part 10. Freya. The first thing Hayden did after he took over was to quietly rename the Sisters K channel the Freya K channel. And a few months after that, to quietly drop the K. That was how easy it was to disappear my sister. I continued to record songs and make videos, though now his team produced them. At first, they didn't look or sound so different from the videos Sabrina and I had made. They dropped weekly on Tuesdays, same as always. But with every new addition, Hayden deleted a couple of the Sisters K videos. If it was gradual, Hayden said, the fans wouldn't even notice. Turn up the heat slowly, he said, and the frogs in the pot won't know they're boiling. He looked at me. Soon, no one will remember the Sisters K ever existed. By that point, I wondered if my sister remembered I existed. Sabrina had not said a word when Mom announced that I would work with Hayden alone. She hadn't even looked that surprised, probably because Mom had consulted with her ahead of time. She didn't say a cross word to me, didn't accuse me of betraying her or selling her out, didn't yell at me or call me a bitch. If anything, she was more benignly pleasant to me than she'd ever been. But 2 months after we inked the deal with Hayden, she moved upstate to finish college and didn't come home or speak to me after that. Bit by bit, Hayden began to change the sound and look of my videos, nudging them, me, grittier by degrees, transforming what he dismissively called the suburban cover artist into someone edgier, more glamorous, more raw. I'm not changing you, he claimed. I'm revealing you. We had lived in White Plains, but after a year, we moved to Williamsburg, which was closer to his office and more in line with my brand. Hayden had a furnished sublet we could have for cheap. Mom gave up the apartment I'd grown up in, and the family we once were disappeared entirely. Hayden stuck to his 2-year plan with the precision of a German train. After a year had gone by, a year of building my brand, getting me out there and visible, turning me into a commodity. We dropped the first single and took down nearly all the previous work from SoundCloud. "Gotta get your fans used to paying for the milk," Hayden said. There were some fans who objected, who accused me of selling out. Some even asked what had happened to Sabrina. "Has your sister died?" they wrote. But these comments remained in the minority, as I was discovered by more and more new fans who had never heard of Sabrina. I was the talent, I was told, because I was the voice. But really, Hayden was the voice. Hayden made the calls. My look, my hook, my sound. He dictated all of it. When it came time to record the album, he hired a team of songwriters to create what he said would be a moody, atmospheric, and, without a touch of irony, confessional album. He employed a director who would shoot several videos simultaneously to solidify the brand. "People want to see inside the real you," he said, "and we'll show them that." He presented me a list of songs he'd chosen to record. 12 of them were written by his team, but number 13 was my song. It was White Dress. "Sing me a song that proves it," Hayden had commanded as soon as I'd closed the door behind me that fateful day in his office. Sabrina had just sung to Hai Hailu, and when she'd emerged from Hayden's office, she wouldn't look me in the eye, dispelling any doubts I'd had about what she'd done. "Proves what?" I'd asked him. "That you are the only one I want," he'd said. That was the first, last, and only time I'd sung him White Dress. "White Dress?" I asked Hayden 2 years later, looking at his list of songs. "How can I record that?" "How can you not record that?" He stared at me for one silent, squirmy moment. He didn't know the history of the song, other than it was the one I'd sung for him, choking back tears, all the while thinking that if Sabrina was going to betray me, I was going to betray her back. Had Hayden seen the bloody dagger in my hand? Had he been the one who'd given it to me in the first place? "It'll need to be rewritten, of course," Hayden said, taking back the list. "But I do love that song." By the time his team finished with it, the song was radically different. What had been just vocals and percussion was filled out with lush instrumentals. The lyrics had been rewritten so it sounded like an angry love song. The Amharic lyrics were gone, but the DNA of the song was still there. The melody was mine. And the story behind it, that was, for better or for worse, still mine. We were 3 weeks into recording when it came up on the schedule. It started out as a normal enough day. I woke at 8, did some yoga, ate a light nutritionist-approved breakfast, drank some herbal tea, no coffee on singing days because it was an irritant, though Hayden sometimes gave me a caffeine tablet to compensate. Did a baking soda and water gargle, self-consciously warmed up in the back of the car Hayden sent to bring us to the studio. When we got to the studio that morning, it was already crowded, more so than usual. In addition to Hayden, his assistants, and the engineers, there were a handful of label execs and some other people I didn't know. Everyone was hunched around a monitor. "Freya, look," Mom said. "They've mocked up a few prototypes for the art." "Don't get too attached," Hayden warned. "They're just ideas." I peered at the images. Body parts, black and white and sultry, the face half showing. The name Freya in huge type. I didn't recognize myself. I'd been Freya Kebede, the sister's K. And now I was just Freya, a menagerie of well-lit body parts. "Let's get to work," Hayden said. Usually we did a take or two to warm up. Then we began recording. Sometimes Hayden would stop in between takes to give a note. Go soft here, hit that note harder. But this time, he kept shaking his head. Nope, he said over and over. Not there yet, not even close. This kept up all morning. When it was time to break for lunch, Hayden waved everyone out of the booth and came into the studio to talk to just me. He didn't say anything for a while, just stared at me. I looked around for my mother, an assistant, anyone, but they'd left me alone with him. Freya, he said, look at me. I made myself look at him. You're not giving me what I want. I'm doing what I've been doing, I replied. So I don't know what you want. I want you, he said. I want the real you. But who was that? The girl who'd been born singing? The girl who'd betrayed her sister? The girl who could be the next Lulia? The girl in pieces on the computer screen? I don't know who that is. Hayden tapped himself on the chest. I know who that is, he said. I've always known. It's why I chose you. So give me what I want. I just said I don't know what you want. More intensity? More growl? More volume? Tell me. From inside the booth, I saw Nick, the engineer, return. He pressed the intercom. We've got some pretty good takes, Hayden. She can maybe punch out a few lines and we'll get it in the mix. When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it, Hayden told Nick. He turned back to me. This song can't be done piecemeal, Freya. This song only works if we can hear your guts on a platter, hear your chest splayed open, so dig down deep and figure it out, and sing me that fucking song the way you sang it in my office. Hayden went back to the board, sitting beside a now frowning Nick. I put my headphones back on and I sang. I sang that song to the bone. I sandpapered my voice, going back in time, year by year, through all the layers of varnish, through all the broken promises, trying to dig back to the girl who was born singing. I sang my voice raw, sang my heart to shreds looking for that girl. Did I find her? Had she ever even existed? It was dark out when I finished the final, bloodiest take. Hayden came out of the booth, clapping his hands slowly. He was smiling proudly, almost, you might say, paternally. That, he said, is the song that will make you famous. 8. The Sabrina Way. Freya has always known where to find Sabrina. When her sister moved away to that college upstate, Freya looked up the school online. She spent hours on the school's website, picturing her sister living in one of the dorms, or taking notes in the lecture halls, or playing piano, if she still played, in the music studios. When Sabrina graduated, Freya knew that she'd moved to the city, although the opposite side of it from her. Freya has charted the route from her place in Williamsburg to Sabrina's Harlem apartment many times. L train to the A train to 145th Street. An hour door to door, according to Google Maps. So even though she's never been there, she knows how to get there. Outside the building, Freya's heart pounds in her head, a steady, percussive beat. She looks for her sister's name on the buzzer, and there it is. Kabede Takashita. She said yes. Someone is leaving the building, so Freya slips into the vestibule without buzzing first. The apartment is on the 6th floor. The elevator clanks all the way up. Ba-boom, ba-boom, echoing Freya's heaving heart. Her hand trembles as she knocks. A man answers. Tall, thin, delicate-featured, with a professorial air. Alex Takashita in the flesh. "Can I help you?" he asks. Freya is suddenly tongue-tied, unable not only to sing, but to speak. Why is she here? Did she think stealing a song from Hayden, a song Sabrina always hated, would undo anything? Did she think a hug with Haroon's sister would deliver back her own? "I'm looking for my mother," Freya finally manages to stutter. Alex squints through his glasses at her. It occurs to Freya that he might not even know who she is. When Freya first met with a media trainer to practice how she'd talk about various parts of her life, she'd asked, "What do I say about my sister?" And the trainer had replied, "What sister?" Does this man who is marrying her sister not even know Freya exists? Has Sabrina struck Freya from the record? Has Freya not done the exact same thing? "Of course," Alex says. "Come in." Freya steps into an airy apartment, all hardwood floors, leaded glass windows, views of treetops. A piano sits in the corner, sheet music and pencils on the desk. Unlike the apartment that she's been living in for the past year, which came furnished, towels already in the linen closet, plates already in the kitchen cabinets, a piano that has seen no fresh composition on it during Freya's tenure, this apartment looks like people actually live in it. "Let me get Sabrina," Alex says. In a different context, Freya might not recognize her sister. Her face has narrowed, her hair, always worn long, is cut into a pixie. It sharpens her angles, shows off her eyes. She looks, Freya sees, more like their father. "You're here for Mom?" Sabrina asks after only the slightest pause. She shakes her head. "How fitting. She's looking for you." "Why?" Alex and Sabrina exchange one of those looks, wordless but telling. Freya feels an ache, that age-old desire to have someone to understand her like that. "She was worried," Alex says. "But why?" Sabrina frowns. "You didn't answer any calls or texts. And she tracked your phone and it showed you in Central Park, not moving. And then there was an Amex charge from an urgent care. So she thought maybe you'd been hurt, or hurt yourself. She went to the police." "What? That doesn't make any sense. Freya's mother hasn't called all day. No one has." Freya fishes out her phone for the first time, she now realizes, since she was back in the diner several hours ago. Usually, if she is away from her phone for more than a few minutes, her home screen has blown up with texts and alerts. But it's blank. She presses the home button and nothing happens. She asks Sabrina to call her phone. Sabrina does, but the phone in Freya's hand remains dark. And suddenly it makes sense. I dropped my phone in the park," she tells her sister. "That's why the GPS thinks it's there." "You might have knocked your antenna loose," Alex says. "I can take a look." "Oh, thanks." Freya hands Alex the phone, and he hurries away with it, likely relieved to be away from the drama. Not that Freya can blame him. "You should call Mom," Sabrina says, handing over her own phone. "She's frantic." Freya shakes her head. If she calls her mother, she will wind up talking to her manager, and she's done being managed. "Can you just text her that I'm not dead?" Sabrina taps at her phone. The response comes in almost immediately. "She wants you to call her," Sabrina says, reading along as the texts fire in. "Now. She says it's urgent. She says Hayden called and..." "Stop!" Freya's voice is loud and firm, and for once, Sabrina listens. I'm not here to talk to Mom. I see. Sabrina puts down her phone and walks over to the dining table, upon which is an open bottle of wine. She pours herself a glass. So, why are you here? Freya doesn't have an answer. All she knows is that after all that's happened today, with the miracle doctor, and with Hayden, and with Haroon and Nathaniel, she needs to be here. To congratulate you, Freya blurts, on your engagement. To her surprise, the tidings are sincere. She is happy that Sabrina is happy. Sabrina holds up her hand, the tiny engagement ring throwing prisms against the wall. She marvels, less at the ring, it seems, than at her own good fortune. Thank you, she says quietly. She drops her hands in her lap. Did Mom tell you? Mom hasn't told me a thing about you in 2 years, Freya says. I found out on Facebook. I didn't post anything. Alex did. She said yes. Ah. Sabrina smiles indulgently toward the room where Alex has gone to tinker with the phone. Then she looks at Freya. Still stalking ghosts on Facebook? Only yours. Sabrina's eyebrow arcs in surprise. Why? Why? Are you serious? You're my sister. At least, I think you're still my sister. I don't know. Am I? Sabrina asks, her voice uncertain, as if she truly doesn't know. This rattles Freya. She's used to the granite Sabrina. She came girded to confront that Sabrina, but she doesn't know what to do with this tender, unsure person. Do you ever hear from him? Sabrina asks. Who? Her sister's eye roll is, at least, comfortingly familiar. Dad. Not Solomon, but Dad. Not for a while, Freya says. What about you? No. But I'm not you. What's that supposed to mean? It means I'm not famous anymore, or almost famous. Neither am I. But surely famous enough to get his attention. There's pain in her sister's eyes, and Freya wonders just which one of them has been trying to get their father's attention all these years. Freya shrugs. I'm not famous. And if I'm almost famous, not for much longer. What do you mean? Isn't it all about to explode? Sabrina blows out her hands, an identical gesture to the one Hayden made for them years ago. Mom didn't tell you? Tell me what? Never mind. She looks at Sabrina and takes a deep breath. It's now or never. Why did you sing to Hai Halu in Hayden's office that day? The instant she sees the blood drain from her sister's face, Freya understands that she isn't the only one who's replayed that day over and over again. Sabrina stands up to refill her wine, filling a glass for Freya, too. Do you know what Hayden told me in his office that day? She asks, handing Freya the wine. How would I? I thought maybe he told you. Sabrina shakes her head. But then again, why would he? What did he say? He said I had a pretty voice, maybe even prettier than yours, and that I wrote a decent song, but that he wasn't interested in me. Only you. I asked why. He'd just told me that I was a better singer than you, and we both know I wrote better songs. He was blunt. He said I wasn't interesting enough, wasn't special enough, and wasn't hungry enough. There are tears in Sabrina's eyes as she continues. And it wasn't like I didn't know. I'd seen how the fans reacted to you, seen how much you needed that. But I was so pissed off. So I told Hayden he had it all wrong. You weren't hungry. You were desperate. That our father fed you a story about being born singing and then disappeared, leaving you nothing but that false legacy and a pathetic white dress. I told him that every song you sang, from that very first viral video to Little White Dress, was really about you trying to get him back. He didn't know about the original video, so he asked what song it was. When I finished, he looked at me and said, "Where do you think hunger comes from? It comes from desperation." And that was it. He thanked me, told me I was very helpful, and I realized what I'd done. Hayden was a shark circling you, and I poured blood in the water. But before I could fix it or warn you, he dismissed me and called you in. And I sang Little White Dress. And you sang Little White Dress. I betrayed you. Only because I betrayed you first. Have you ever heard that song, Sabrina? Of course I have. I know you've listened to it, but I don't think you've heard it. What's the difference? Sabrina rolls her eyes, skeptical. The difference is everything. But Freya doesn't know how to explain it. So instead, she sings what she can't say. Sings what her sister can't hear. You must confess. I'm a white-hot mess, and I need you here. Need you near to quench my fear. Freya's voice is strangled, as bad as it was that day in the studio, as bad as it's been every day since. She keeps going. Did the thing I said I would? Let music do what words never could. You're a thorn in my side, but loving you is how I survive. All that I said I wanted was a little white dress. All that I said I needed was a little white dress. Do you remember? We used to sing a shoo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Eshuru, ru-ru-ru, eshuru, ru-ru-ru. Hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye. And though I obsess about being a black tar mess, I'd rather have you than a little white dress. The song sounds nothing like it did in the recording studio. Nothing like it did on Freya's iPhone all those years ago. Nothing like it did when she first sang it to her sister, trying to sing what she could not say. Don't leave me alone. I need you. I love you. But maybe this is how the song is meant to be sung, because for the first time, Sabrina seems to hear it. There's a tremble in her chin. Sabrina tries to tough it out, but the tremble becomes a wobble, and then her stony expression cracks, revealing the human who's always lived underneath. That song isn't for Dad, Sabrina says. No, Freya says. It's not. You wrote that about me. Sabrina says. I wrote that about us. Sabrina does something Freya has never once seen her sister do. She starts to cry. And Freya does something that, until today, she's never had the opportunity to do. She wraps her arms around her sister and comforts her. It doesn't last long, because it's still Sabrina. She quickly wipes away her tears and disentangles herself from the embrace. "What the hell happened to your voice?" she asks, the question delivered in a typically direct and indelicate way. In the Sabrina way. And for this reason, it makes Freya laugh. "I don't know," she says, cracking up. "I just lost it." "You lost it?" The laughter is infectious, and soon Sabrina is convulsing with it too. "How do you lose it? Did you leave it in a taxi?" This makes Freya double over. "I don't know why I'm laughing," she says. "We had to stop recording. It's a total disaster." "That's terrible," Sabrina says, wheezing for breath. "What are you going to do now?" "I don't know," Freya admits, sobering up a little. "Well, you'd better figure it out in 2 years," Sabrina says, wiping away an errant tear. "What's in 2 years?" "My wedding." "Why would I have to?" Freya trails off as she understands what Sabrina is asking. Sabrina, who also never knew how to say things. "You want me to sing at your wedding?"
"Not if you sound like that."
"And if I do sound like that?" The question hangs in the air, and Freya is terrified of what she just asked, what Sabrina might say. And then her sister says this. "We'll come up with a plan B." Something expands in Freya's chest. Acorns, after all, eventually bloom. They seed new oak trees. Whole groves of them.
"Or even a plan C," Freya murmurs.
"Got it working,"
Alex says, emerging with Freya's phone. It's blowing up with the day's missed notifications. All her mentions, her views, her likes, her engagements, all her texts and emails and missed calls. There are several voicemails from Hayden she knows she will never listen to, and dozens of texts from her mother that she will have to find a new language to respond to. The phone continues to buzz with the things Freya mistook for love. Buried amid all the noise is Halima's text with Harun's number. Buried amid all the noise is actual love. In the quiet of that moment, in the sanctuary of that love, something happens to Freya. She is lifted outside of herself, outside of this apartment, outside of her own loss, and into Harun's. All of the stories he has yet to tell her about airplanes and Aladdin and James unspool inside her and become her own. Just as she now understands, Nathaniel's loss has somehow merged with her own. It sounds like a burden to take this on, but really, it's the opposite. To be the holder of other people's loss is to be the keeper of their love. To share your loss with people is another way of giving your love. And suddenly, Freya does know what she's going to do. She's going to hug her sister and then walk out of here and track down Nathaniel and Harun, these two strangers who entered her life today and showed her what love really looks like. She has no idea where they are, but if Hayden Booth has taught her one lesson, it's that if you want something bad enough, you'll find a fucking way to make it happen. She's going to find them. The rest will sort itself out. She clicks on Harun's number to open a text. Tell me where to find you.
The Order of Loss, Part 11. Harun. The last time I saw James was a beautiful spring day, as warm and soft as the day he found the $50 bill weeks earlier had been brittle and cold. The trees were in bloom. The women in the city had on dresses, and the boys wore tank tops that showed varying degrees of sculpted perfection. We met that day in the park. James seemed happy. He was prattling on about getting his in-state residency after being in New York for a year, and how he'd be able to start at LaGuardia Community College in the fall, and how they had a food service management program, which wasn't exactly what he wanted, but maybe he could transfer to the Institute of Culinary Education. I only half listened to him. The day before, Ami had assembled a list of gifts to buy. I had been fitted by a tailor for a formal kurta. My passport had returned from the consulate with a visa glued into its pages. I emailed or texted with Amer every day. When I had first realized what he'd done, I had been so angry at him. What had given him the right? Who had given him the right? But I realized that I had. By being a coward. By relinquishing control. And anyway, my cousin seemed so optimistic about the way things were going. Am I boring you? James asked. I startled back to reality. What? I've been talking to you, and I bet you can't tell me one word I just said. Culinary Institute, I said. Two words. He shook his head. You're distracted. He gestured toward the shirtless confections sunning themselves in the meadow. If I didn't know any better, I'd say you were stepping out. He was so completely off base. I'd never had any interest in the confections beyond the aesthetic. And yet, completely on the nose. Because wasn't marrying someone else the definition of stepping out? He'd been teasing until he saw my expression. His face fell. But he wasn't devastated. Not yet. He would not tell me that I'd devastated him, ruined him, for another few hours. At that moment, he thought I'd maybe hooked up with some other guy. Jay, I began. He held up his hand. You still want to be with me? There was nothing else in the world I wanted. I nodded. Then I don't want to know. Do what you got to do. I'm your first, and I plan to be your last. But if you need to figure out what it is you ain't missing, I'm not going to stop you. This was James, giving me permission to be with someone else so I could be sure it was him I really loved. Because he was unselfish and brave, and because he loved me. Just be safe, because I don't want to catch any nasty-ass shit from some confection, he said. You won't, I said. And don't go falling in love, because that I can't take. I won't, I promised. For the rest of the afternoon, I let him think that I was having it off with some guy. And I let myself think that if he was okay with me hooking up with some guy, maybe he'd understand me being with some girl whom I wouldn't even hook up with. Not that often, anyway. And whom I'd certainly never love. After that, we had an okay afternoon. We fell asleep in Sheep Meadow and got food from the halal cart James liked best and walked all the way to the top of the park, where, hidden by foliage and ferns and caressed by the welcoming spring breeze, we loved each other in the ways we knew how. James was normally chatty during sex, but that day, weighed down by what he thought was my infidelity, he was quiet. I, on the other hand, who was normally quiet, was so overcome with love and fear and anguish that I cried out. Just you try to find someone better than me, he said after. He smiled, the saddest smile. And I knew that marrying a girl so I could keep hiding James from my family was not the same as hooking up with some confection. Next Thursday, he said, as we exchanged one final kiss under the cherry tree before he went uptown and I went home. Park again, if the weather holds. How easy it would have been to say yes, to milk one more day out of it, to come up with some excuse about why I'd be away for 6 weeks, to continue doing this with James for as long as I could, to continue deceiving him into thinking there was a future for us when I'd known all along there was not. I put my hand atop James's chest. His heart beat strong and true under my fingertips. His open, loving heart, willing to shelter me in my secrets and my insecurities, and even my infidelity. Willing to pay a price for things he cared about. My heart was defective, not because it loved the wrong person, but because it beat in the chest of a coward. But even a coward has his limits. Even a defective heart knows right from wrong. I moved my hands to the sides of his face, drawing him to me the way he had done that first time we'd kissed. I have to tell you a secret, I whispered. And for that one beautiful moment, before I spoke again, there was James's face, exquisite, expectant, all heat and warmth and optimism that the spring will return, that the sun will shine on all of us, waiting to receive my secret as he'd received me. 9. Broken Hearts. Haroon has always known where to find James. When he hopped from one couch to another, from cousin to aunt, Haroon found out the location of the latest crash pad, committing it to memory. It made him feel better, knowing where to find him in case he lost him. He could have gone to James's aunt's apartment any time. He could have made some excuse for where he was going and taken the path to Manhattan, then transferred to the subway uptown all the way to the last stop, end of the line, James said, and walked the 5 blocks and knocked on the door, and surprised James for no good reason except that he loved him. But he didn't. Until now. His hand trembles as he rings the buzzer. There is so much he has to say to James. That he has told his family, and it was every bit as bad as he thought it would be, but that he finally understands, maybe a little, what James meant when he said coming out to his father was worth the fallout. He'll never live down the terrible thing he made Nathaniel do for him, but the shame that has ridden atop his shoulders, an invisible and heavy stowaway since he was 9 years old, has begun to, if not disembark entirely, at least pack its bags. And that, as James might say, ain't nothing. And he wants to tell him about Freya, about this astonishing day. Maybe he won't believe him, but Haroon will play him the song that's tucked into his keychain, and when he hears that voice, he'll believe. But mostly, he wants to tell James that he's sorry, and he loves him. He's buzzed through, and he climbs the stairs to apartment 3C. He knocks. An older woman, dressed in nurse's scrubs, wearing a lanyard from Presbyterian Hospital, answers the door. Help you, she says. Is James here? He asks. The woman, who must be James's Aunt Colette, looks directly at Haroon. Her eyes, Haroon sees, are the same eyes as James's, brown and gold and warm. At least until she seems to understand who he is, and the suspicion rolls in like a cloud and removes all the warmth. You, Colette says. you him? Harun nods.